instant, even her anger was wiped clean away. It came back.
Who?
She asked, in a deadly seethe of a voice. Sarai felt a tremor of misgiving for having opened the door to her secret. But she didn't see that Laszlo could be kept secret much longer. Not if there was to be any hope of the different future that she hoped for.
He's one of the Ferengi,
she said, trying to sound strong for his sake. Laszlo deserved to be spoken of with pride.
You've never seen such dreams, men. The beauty he sees in the world, and in me. It can change things. I can feel it.
Did she think she could sway her? Did she imagine Minya would ever listen?
So that's it,
said the girl.
A man makes eyes at you. And just like that, you're ready to turn your back on us and go play house and weep. Are you so hungry for love? I might expect as much of Ruby, but not of you.
Oh, that bright little treacherous voice. I'm not turning my back on anyone, said Sarai.
The point is that humans don't have to despise us. If we could just talk to them, then we would see if there might be a chance. A chance for us to live and not merely exist. Minya, I can bring a message for Errol Fane. He could come up tomorrow, and then we'd know. By all means,
said Minya.
Bring him, and your lover too. Bring all the Ferengi, why don't you? How convenient if we could take them all out at once. That would be a big help, actually. Thank you, Sarai.
Take them all out, she repeated, dull.
Was I not clear? Any human who sets foot in the Citadel will die.
Tears of futility burned Sarai's eyes. Minya's mind, like her body, was immutable. Whatever accounted for the unnatural stasis that had kept her a child for 15 years, it was beyond the reach of reason or persuasion. She would have her carnage and her vengeance and drag everyone into it with her.
You could give Minya a nice, warm hug,
Sparrow had said to Ruby in the garden. She hadn't meant it, and the poisonous thought, the shocking, inconceivable, unthinkable notion of the five of them doing harm to one another, had made Sarai ill. She felt ill now, too, looking into the burning eyes of the little girl who'd given her a life, and asking herself how. How she could just stand by and let her start a war. She wanted to scream. She wanted to scream her moths.
You were quite clear,
she spat. Her moths were burgeoning. They wanted out. She wanted out. The sun had set. The sky was not full dark, but it was dark enough. She faced the small tyrant, heir to Scathis in cruelty at least, if not in gift. Her fists clenched, her teeth clenched. The scream built in her, as violent as the first one, years ago, that she'd held in for weeks, so certain it was bad.
Bad would be good,
Minya had said then.
We need bad.
And thus had the Muse of Nightmares been born, and Sarai's fate decided in those few words.
Go on, then,
said Minya now. Her fists, too, were clenched, and her face was wild, half mad with rage and resentment.
I can see you want to. Go down to your humans, if that's all you care about. Your lover must be waiting. Go to him, Sarai.
She bared her small white teeth.
Tell him, I can't wait to meet him.
Sarai was trembling. Her arms were stiff at her sides. Leaning toward Minya, she opened her mouth and screamed. No sound came out, only moths. All at Minya, right at Minya. a torrent of darkness, frantic wings, and fury. They spewed at her. They poured at her. They flew in her face, and she gave a cry, trying to duck out of their path. They dipped when she did. She couldn't escape them. They beat their wings at her face and hair, the stream of them parting around her like a river around a rock. Past her, out of the alcove, over the heads of the ghosts standing guard, and out into the twilight. Sarai stood where she was, still screaming, and though no sound came out, her voice having gone, her lips shaped the words, "Get out! Get out! Get out!" until Minya picked herself up from her cower, and, with a terrible look, turned and fled. Sarai collapsed onto her bed, heaving with silent sobs, and her moths winged down and down. They didn't divide, because her mind would not divide. She thought only of Laszlo, so that was where they flew. Straight to the house and the window she knew so well, into the room where she hoped to find him sleeping. But it was early yet. His bed was empty and his boots gone. So the moths, fluttering with agitation, had no choice but to settle down and wait. Chapter 54. Too Lovely Not to Devour. Laszlo didn't want to talk to anyone except Sarai. He just didn't think he could keep his composure through any more talk of the Godspawn, be it well-meant or ill. He half-considered climbing in his window to avoid Suhaila, but he couldn't do that. So he went in by the green door and found her in the courtyard. Supper was waiting.
"Don't worry," she told him straight away. "Just a light meal. I know you're probably eager for sleep."
He was, and he could have done well enough without supper. But he made himself pause. Sarai was her grandchild, after all, her only one. He'd been angry that morning that she and Errol Fane hadn't met the news of her existence gladly. But in light of what the Tysercane reaction had been, he saw that theirs had been generous, if honest. He tried to appreciate what this all meant for her. She set out bowls of soup and hung a fresh disc of bread from the big hook. It had seeds and petals baked into it in a pattern of overlapping circles. A light meal, maybe, but she must have spent hours on it. Usually she was effortlessly chatty, but not tonight. He saw a shy but shame-faced curiosity in her, and several times she'd seemed about to speak, and then think better of it. "The other day," he said, "you told me just to ask. Now it's my turn. It's all right. You can ask." Her voice was timorous.
Does she hate us very much?"
"No," he said. "She doesn't hate you at all." And he felt confident that it was true. She talked of the paradox at the core of her being, and the curse of knowing one's enemies too well to be able to hate them. Maybe she used to, but not anymore. He wanted to tell her that Sarai understood, but that absolution could come only from Sarai. He ate fast, and Suhaila made him tea. He declined it at first, eager to go, but she said it would help him fall asleep faster.
"Oh, then that would be wonderful."
He drained it in a gulp, thanked her, paused to press her hand, and went at last to his room. He opened the door and halted on the threshold. Moths. Moths were perched on the wooden headboard and the pillows and the wall behind the bed, and when the door opened, they lifted into the air like leaves stirred by a wind. Sarai, he thought. He didn't know what to make of their numbers. They overwhelmed him, not with fear, or, gods forbid, disgust, but with awe and a prickle of dread. Maybe he brought all the dread with him from the guard station and the brutal, bloody words of his friends. And maybe the moths brought some of it on their furred twilight wings. He understood one thing in the swirl of creatures. Sarai was waiting for him. He closed the door. He would have washed and shaved his face, cleaned his teeth, brushed his hair, changed. He blushed at the thought of taking off his shirt, though he knew she'd seen him sleeping that way before. He settled for brushing his teeth and taking off his boots, and then he lay down. Overhead, moths clustered on the ceiling beam like a branch in dark bloom. He realized, once he was settled, that he'd left enough room on the bed for Sarai, on the side she'd chosen in the dream, though all that was needed was his brow for moths to perch on. Some other time it might have made him laugh at himself, but not tonight. Tonight he only felt her absence from a world that didn't want her. He didn't move over, but closed his eyes, feeling the moths all around him. Sarai all around him. He was breathless for sleep to come so that he could be with her. And tonight there was no euphoria keeping him awake. There was only a slow sinking. And soon enough, the moth, the brow, the threshold of the dream. Sarai found herself in the amphitheater market. She craved the color and sweetness of dreamer's weep, as she thought of it. But here were neither. The place was empty. A wind scoured through, blowing scraps of refuse past her ankles, and a terrible pit of fear opened in her. Where was all the color? There should have been silks fluttering, music in the air, and laughter drifting down from the children on their high wires. There were no children on the high wires, and all the market stalls were bare. Some even looked burned, and there wasn't a sound to be heard. The city had stopped breathing. Sarai stopped breathing too. Had she made this place to reflect her despair? Or was it Laszlo's creation? That seemed impossible. Her soul needed Dreamer's Weep, and she needed him. There he was, right there, his long hair wild in the wind. His face was somber, the easy joy gone from it. But there was still, Sarai breathed again, such witchlight in his eyes. She had witchlight in her own. She felt it go out from her like something that could touch him. She stepped forward, following in its path. He stepped forward too. They came to stand face to face, arms reach without reaching. The three strings that joined them wound them ever nearer. Hearts, lips, navels. Closer, still not touching. The air between them was a dead place, as though both of them were carrying their hopelessness before them, hoping for the other to dash it away. They held everything they had to say, every desperate thing, and they didn't want to say any of it. They just wanted it to vanish, here, at least, in this place that was theirs.
"Well," remarked Sarai, "that was a long day."
This earned a surprised laugh from Laszlo.
"The longest," he agreed. "Were you able to sleep at all?"
"I was," she reported, finding a small smile. "I turned my nightmares into fireflies and caught them in a jar."
"That's good," Laszlo breathed. "I was worried." He blushed. "I may have thought about you a few times today."
"Only a few?"
she teased, blushing too.
"Maybe more," he admitted.
He reached for her hand. It was hot, and so was his. The edges of their hopelessness dissolved, just a little.
"I thought about you, too,"
said Sarai, lacing their fingers together. Brown and blue, blue and brown. She was transfixed by the sight of them. She murmured,
"And it's only fair to tell you that I dreamed of you."
"Oh? I hope I was well-behaved."
"Not too well-behaved."
Coyly, she added,
"No better than this morning, when the sun so rudely rose."
She meant the kiss. He understood.
"The sun. I still haven't forgiven it."
The space between them could only shrink, not grow. Laszlo's voice was music, the most beautiful, smoky music, when he caught Sarai up in his arms and said, "I want to catch it in a jar and put it away with the fireflies. The moon on a bracelet and the sun in a jar," said Sarai. "We really wreak havoc on the heavens, don't we?"
Laszlo's voice sank deeper in his throat, smokier, hungrier.
"I expect the heavens will survive," he said, and then he kissed her. How had they survived a whole day on the merest touch that was last night's kiss? If they'd known then what a kiss was, they couldn't have. It would have been unbearable to come so close, to barely feel and almost taste, and be snatched apart before, well, before this. But they hadn't known. And now they did. Now, right now, they learned. Sarai leaned into Laszlo, her eyes closing in anticipation. His were slower. He wanted to see her. He didn't want to miss even a second of her face. Her smooth cerulean loveliness held him spellbound. There was a dusting of nearly invisible freckles on the bridge of her nose. The glide of their faces was as slow as poured honey, and her lips. Ever so slightly, they parted. The bottom one, voluptuous as dew-bright fruit, parted from its fellow, for him. And it was the most enticing thing he'd ever seen. A blaze of desire surged through him, and he leaned into the honey slowness, pushing the hopelessness out of his way to take that sweet, soft lip between his own. The searing softness, the melt. When Laszlo had wished to discover, with Sarai, the realm of the unknowable, he had thought of great, huge mysteries like the origin and nature of gods. But right now, he'd have given it all up for this small mystery, this tiny, newest, and best mystery of weep. This kiss. This exact kiss. Lips. The wonder of lips that could brush or press, part and close, and, parting, closing, catch the other's lip in the sweetest of bites. Not a true bite, not teeth. Ah, teeth were still a secret. But the tip of the tongue, well, hopelessness had little chance against the discovery of the tip of the tongue. And the thing that was almost blinding, unfathomable, was this. Heady as it was, so heady he felt dizzy from it, tipsy. Still he sensed that even this was only the threshold to another realm of the unknowable. A door pushed just ajar, and the thinnest sliver of light hinting of radiance beyond. He felt light and heavy at the same time, burning, floating. He'd never suspected. He'd been aware of girls, of course, and had all the sorts of thoughts that young men have. The better ones, anyway. Better young men and better thoughts. And of course he wasn't ignorant of the biology of things. But he'd never had any inkling of what he now sensed lay beyond that tantalizing door. It was a radiance that felt rich and deep and huge and close and secret and delirious and sacred. It was his future with the girl he held in his arms. And whatever he had felt and feared on his walk home from the guard station, now he was certain. There would be a future. Hope was easy, after all. Here in this place, anyway. He drew her closer, his arms full around her waist, and lost himself in the marvel of her, of this. He breathed the scent and taste of her, and shivered when her fingers traced up his arms to the nape of his neck. She wove them through his hair, and awakened more sensation, a fire of pleasure that radiated down his shoulders and up his scalp, nudging at that tantalizing door with all its luminous secrets. When he broke the kiss, finally, it was to press his face to hers, the ridge of his brow to hers, his cheekbone rough against hers, smooth.
Sarai, he breathed against her cheek.
He felt like a glass filled with splendor and luck. His lips curved into a smile. He whispered,
"You have ruined my tongue for all other tastes,"
and understood finally what that phrase meant. Sarai pulled back, just enough that they could look at each other. Her amazement mirrored his own, her gaze the equivalent of a whispered,
"Oh,"
husky and astonished and awakened. The laughter reached them first, children's laughter, and then the color. They broke their gaze to look around, and saw the city no longer holding its breath. There were swallowtail flags snapping on the domes, and the sky was a mosaic of kites, and the market stalls were no longer empty, but coming to life as though opening for the morning, with vendors in long aprons setting out their wares. Flocks of brilliant butterflies moved through like schools of fish, and the upper levels of the amphitheater were espaliered with jeweled fruit trees.
"That's better,"
sighed Sarai. Up in the citadel, her tears dried on her cheeks. The clench of her fists and stomach relaxed.
"Much better," Laszlo agreed. "Do you think we just did that?" "I'm certain of it."
"Well done, us," he said, then added, with exaggerated nonchalance,
"I wonder what would happen if we kept kissing."
In a similar display of feigned indifference, Sarai shrugged and said,
"Well, I guess we could find out."
They knew they had to talk about the day and the future and all the hate and despair and helplessness, but not just yet. That place in their minds that had worked their Mahalath transformations was coloring dreamers weep with their snatched and grabbed happiness. Everything else could wait.
"Laszlo,"
Sarai whispered, and she asked him a question to which he already knew the answer.
"Do you still want me in your mind?"
"Sarai," he replied,
"I want you."
His arms were already around her. He drew her even closer.
"In my mind." "Good."
She bit her lip, and the sight of her fine white teeth bearing down on that decadent, delicate lip planted at least an unconscious thought in his mind regarding the potential of teeth in kissing.
"I'm going to go to sleep,"
she told him.
"I'm already lying in my bed."
She didn't mean to sound seductive, but in her sudden shyness, her voice sank to a whisper, and Laszlo heard it like a purr. He swallowed hard.
"Do you need to lie down here?"
In the dream, he meant, because she had last time.
"I don't think so. Now that we know it works, I think it'll be easy."
She touched the tip of her nose to the tip of his.
"Shaped by fairy tales," she thought,
which made it better than every straight nose in the world.
"But there is one thing you can do for me."
"What is it?" asked Laszlo.
"Anything." "You can kiss me some more," she said.
And he did. Up in the citadel, Sarai's body fell asleep. And as soon as it did, she stopped being the girl lying on the bed, and she stopped being the moth perched on Laszlo's brow, and became only, and gloriously, the girl in his arms. Kissing, it turned out, was one of those things that only got better the more of it one did, and became more interesting as one gained confidence. Oh, the ways that lips could know each other, and tongues, how they could tease and tingle. Tongues, how they could lick. Some things, thought Sarai, were too lovely to devour, while others were too lovely not to. And together they learned that kissing wasn't just for mouths. That was a revelation. Well, one mouth was needed, of course. But that mouth might decide to take a small sojourn down to the soft place under the jaw, or the tender, exquisite spot just below the ear, or the earlobe. Who knew? Or the neck, the entire neck. And here was a cunning quirk of physiology. Sarai found that she could kiss Laszlo's neck while he kissed hers. Wasn't that lucky? And it was immensely rewarding to feel his tremors when her lips found a place that felt particularly good. Almost as rewarding as when his found such a place on her. And if not his lips, oh, his teeth. Even up in the citadel, the teeth caused her to shiver.
"I never knew about necks,"
Sarai whispered between fast, hot kisses.
"Neither did I,"
said Laszlo, breathless.
"Or ears. I know. Who could have guessed about ears?"
They were still, all this while, in the marketplace of Dreamer's Weep. Sometime early in the kiss, if one could, with generosity, call it a kiss, a convenient tree grew up from a crack in the cobbles, tall and smooth and canted at just the right angle for leaning when the dizziness became too much. This was never going any farther than leaning. There was, even in the delectation of necks, an innocence born of perfect inexperience combined with politeness. Their hands were hot, but they were hot in safe places. And their bodies were close, but chaste. Well, what does the body know of chastity? Only what the mind insists upon. And if Laszlo's and Sarai's minds insisted, it was not because their bodies failed to present a compelling argument. It was just that it was all so new and so sublime. It might take weeks, after all, just to master necks. Sarai's fingertips did, at some point in the heedless flow of dreamtime, find themselves slipping under the hem of Laszlo's shirt to play ever so lightly over the bare skin of his waist. She felt him shiver, and she sensed, and he did too, how very much remained to be discovered. She tickled him on purpose, and the kiss became a laugh. He tickled back, his hands emboldened, and their laughter filled the air. They were lost inside the dream, no awareness of the real, of rooms or beds or moths or brows. And so it was that in the giddy, sultry world of their embrace, the real Laszlo, fast asleep in the city of Weep, turned over on his pillow, crushed the moth, and broke the dream. Chapter 55. Disfaith. In the real city, Thion Nero walked to the anchor, his satchel slung over his shoulder. Last night, he had made the same walk with the same satchel. He had been weary then, and thinking about napping. He ought to have been wearier now, but he was not. His pulse was reedy. His spirit, depleted by his own depredations, pulsed too fast through his veins, twinning with a whir and discordant jangle of disbelief crashing against evidence, producing a sensation of disfaith. He had stumbled onto something that refused to be believed. His mind was at war with itself. Alchemy and magic, the mystical and the material, demons and angels, gods and men. What was the world? What was the cosmos? Up in the black, were there roads through the stars, travelled by impossible beings? What had he entered into by coming across the world? He reached the anchor. There was the whole broad face of it, visible to any passer-by. Not that there were likely to be passers-by at this late hour of night. And there was the alley with its mural depicting the wretched, bloody gods. The alley was where he'd been doing his testing, where no one would see him if they happened by. If he could have had a fragment of Mesarthium to experiment on in his laboratory, he would have been spared these late-night outings, this risk of discovery. But no fragments existed, for the simplest of reasons. Mesarthium could not be cut. There were no scraps to be had, there was only this massive slab of it, and the other three identical ones at the southern, eastern, and western edges of the city. He returned to his site in the alley, and shifted the debris he had leaned there to screen it from view. And there, at the base of the impregnable anchor, where smooth mesatheum met the stones it had crushed 200 years ago underneath its awful weight, was the solution to Weep's problem. Thion Nero had done it. So why hadn't he sent at once for Errol Fane, and earned himself the envy of all the other delegates and the gratitude of Weep? Well, he had to confirm the results first. Rigor, always. It might have been a fluke. It wasn't. He knew that much. He didn't understand it, and he didn't believe it. But he knew. Stories will be told about me. That was what he had said to Strange back in Zosma. His reason for coming on this journey. It wasn't his main reason, but never mind. That had been escape. From the Queen and his father, and the Chrysoposium, and the stifling box that was his life. Whatever his reason, he was here now, and a story was unfurling before him. A legend was taking shape. He set down his satchel and opened it. More vials and flasks than last night, and a hand glaive to see by. He had several tests to perform this time. The old alkahest and the new. The notes he took were habit and comfort, as though his tidy writing could transform mystery into sense. There was a gaping rent in the metal. It was knee-high, a foot wide at the bottom, and deep enough to reach your arm into. It looked like an axe chop, except that the edges weren't sharp, but smooth, as though they had been melted. The new tests proved what Thion already knew. Not what he understood or believed, but what he knew, in the way that a man who falls on his face knows the ground. Mesatheum was conquered. There was a legend taking shape, but it wasn't his. He packed up his satchel and leaned the debris back up against the anchor to screen the rent from sight. He stood at the mouth of the alley, all reedy pulse and ravaged spirit, wondering what it all meant. Weep gave no answer. The night was silent. He slowly walked away. Across the street, Drave watched, and when the alchemist was gone, he disengaged from the shadows, crept to the mouth of the alley, and went in. Chapter 56. The Dreamsmiths.
"No, no, 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 no!" said Laszlo, bolting upright in his bed.
The moth lay on his pillow like a scrap of sooty velvet. He prodded it with his finger, and it didn't move at all. It was dead. It was Sarai's, and he had killed it. The bizarre, tenuous nature of their connection struck him with new force. That a moth should be their only link. That they could be sharing such a moment and lose it in an instant because he rolled over on his pillow and crushed a moth. He cupped the poor thing on his palm, then set it gently on the night table. It would vanish at dawn, he knew, and be reborn at next nightfall. He'd killed nothing, besides his own ardor. It was funny, really. Absurd, infuriating, and funny. He flopped back onto his pillows and looked up at the moths on his ceiling beam. They were stirring, and he knew that Sarai could see him through their eyes. With a mournful smile, he waved. Up in her room, Sarai laughed, voicelessly. The look on his face was priceless, and his body was limp with helpless vexation.
"Go back to sleep," she willed him. "Now."
He did. Well, it took 10 hours, or perhaps 10 minutes, and then Sarai was standing before him with her hands on her hips.
"Moth killer,"
she admonished him.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I really loved that moth, too.
That one was my favorite.
Better keep your voice down. This one will get its feelings hurt and fly away.
I mean, this one's my favorite, he revised. I promise not to smush it.
Be sure that you don't.
They were both smiling like fools. They were so full of happiness, and Dreamer's weep was colored by it. If only real weep could be so easily set right. It was probably for the best, though, Laszlo ventured.
Oh?
I wouldn't have been able to stop kissing you otherwise. I'm sure I'd be kissing you still.
That would be terrible, she said,
and took a prowling step closer, reaching up to trace a line down the center of his chest.
Wretched, he agreed.
She was lifting her face to his, ready to pick up where they'd left off, and he wanted to melt right back into her, breathe the nectar and rosemary of her, tease her neck with his teeth, and make her mouth curve into its feline curl. It thrilled him that he could make her smile, but he had the gallant notion that he should make best efforts now to do so in other ways.
I have a surprise for you,
he said, before she could kiss him and undermine his good intentions.
A surprise?
She asked, skeptical. In Sir I's experience, surprises were bad.
You'll like it, I promise.
He took her hand and curled it through his arm, and they walked through the marketplace of Dreamer's Weep, where mixed among the commonplace items were wonderful ones, like witch's honey, supposed to give you a fine singing voice. They sampled it, and it did, but only for a few seconds. And there were beetles that could chew gemstones better than any jeweler could cut them, and silence trumpets that, when blown, blasted a blanket of quiet loud enough to smother thunder. There were mirrors that reflected the viewer's aura, and they came with little cards to tell what the colors meant. Sarai's and Laszlo's auras were a matching shade of fuchsia that fell smack between pink for lust and red for love. And when they read it, Laszlo blushed almost the same hue, whereas Sarai went more to violet. They glimpsed the centaur and his lady. She held a parasol and he a string market bag, and they were just another couple out for a stroll, buying vegetables for their supper. And they saw the moon's reflection displayed in a pail of water, never mind that it was daytime, and it wasn't for sale, but free, for whoever was able to catch it. There were sugared flowers and eegee bones, trinkets of gold and carvings of lis. There was even a sly old woman with a barrel full of threevegs.
To bury in your enemy's garden,
she told them with a cackle. Laszlo shuddered. He told Sarai how he'd seen one in the desert. They stopped for sorbet, served in stemmed glasses, and she told him about feral storms and how they would eat the snow with spoonfuls of jam. They talked, walking along. She told him about Orchid Witch and Bonfire, who were like her younger sisters, and he told her of the abbey and the orchard, where once he'd played Tizercane Warriors. He paused before a market stall that did not strike her as especially wonderful, but the way he beamed at it made her take a second look.
Fish? She inquired. That's not my surprise, is it?
No, he said. I just love fish. Do you know why?
Because they're delicious? She hazarded. If they are. I've never tasted fish.
Skyfish being hard to come by.
Yes,
said Sarai. They can be tasty, he said. But it's actually spoiled fish to which I am indebted.
Spoiled fish? You mean rotten?
Not quite rotten. Just gone off, so you wouldn't yet notice. But eat it and get sick. Sarai was bemused.
I see.
You probably don't, said Laszlo, grinning.
Not in the slightest,
Sarai agreed.
If it weren't for spoiled fish,
he said, like the telling of a secret. I would be a monk. Even though he'd been leading up to this disclosure in the spirit of silliness, when he got to it, it didn't feel silly. It felt like the narrowest of escapes, being sent to the library that day so long ago. It felt like the moment the silk sleigh crossed some invisible barrier and the ghosts began to dissolve. I would be a monk, he said, with deepening horror. He took Sarai by the shoulders and said, with resonant conviction, I'm glad I'm not a monk. She still didn't know what he was talking about, but she sensed the shape of it. I'm glad too, she said, hardly knowing whether to laugh. And if ever there was a status, non-monk, worth celebrating with a kiss, this was it. It was a good kiss, but not so fully committal as to require reconjuring the leaning tree. Sarai opened her eyes again, feeling dreamy and obscure, like a sentence half-translated into a beautiful new language. The fish stall was gone, she saw. Something else was in its place. A black tent with gold lettering. Why not fly? She read. Why not fly? No reason she could think of. Why not fly? She turned to Laszlo, thrilled. Here was his surprise.
The Wingsmiths!
She cried, kissing him again. Arm in arm they entered the tent. In the way of dreams, they walked into a black tent, but entered a large, bright courtyard, open to the sky. There were balconies on all four sides, and everywhere were mannequins clad in outlandish garbs, feather suits, and dresses made of smoke and fog and glass. All were complete with goggles, like Solzarin's, but weirder, with luminous yellow lenses and mysterious clockwork gears. One even had a butterfly proboscis, curled up like a fiddlehead. And each mannequin, of course, was crowned by a glorious pair of wings. There were butterfly wings, to go with the proboscis. One pair was sunset orange, swallow-tailed, and scalloped in black. Another an iridescent marvel of viridian and indigo, with tawny spots like cat's eyes. There were even moth wings, but they were pale as the moon, not dusk-dark like Sarai's moths. Bird wings, bat wings, even flying fish wings. Sarai paused before a pair that was covered in soft orange fur. What kind are these? She asked, stroking them. Fox wings, Laszlo told her, as though she might have known. Fox wings, of course. She lifted her chin and said with decision, I'll take the fox wings, please, good sir. An excellent choice, my lady, said Laszlo. Here, let's try them on and see if they fit. The harness was just like the ones in the silk sleigh. Laszlo buckled it for her and picked out his own pair. Dragon wings, he said, and slipped into them like sleeves. Why not fly? The gold letters asked. No reason in the world. Or if there were ample reasons in the world, physics and anatomy and so on, there was at least no reason here. And so they flew. Sarai knew flying dreams, and this was better. It had been her wish when she was little, before her gift manifested and stole her last hope of it. Flying was freedom. But it was also fun. Ridiculous, marvelous fun. And if there had been sunlight just moments ago, it suited them now to have stars. So they did. They were low enough to pick like berries from a branch and string onto the bracelet with her moon. Everything was extraordinary. Laszlo caught Sarai's hand in flight, remembered the first time he'd caught it, and felt the same unmistakable shock of the real. Come down over here, he said. Onto the anchor. Not the anchor, she demurred. It loomed suddenly below them, jutting up from the city. Rasselas is there. I know, said Laszlo. I think we should go and visit him.
What? Why?
Because he's turned over a new leaf, he said. He was tired of being a half-rotted monster, you know. He practically begged me for lips and eyeballs. Sarai gave a laugh.
He did he?
I solemnly swear, said Laszlo. And they hooked their fingers together and descended to the anchor. Sarai alighted before the beast and stared. Lips and eyeballs, indeed. It was still recognizably Scathus's beast, but only just. It was Scathus's beast as remade in Laszlo's mind, and so what had been ugly was made beautiful. Gone was the carrion head with its knife-fang grin. The flesh that had been falling from the bones, Mazathium flesh, Mazathium bones, covered the skull now, and not just with flesh, but fur. And the face had the delicate grace of a spectral mingled with the power of a ravid. Its horns were a more refined version of what they'd been, fluting out to tight spirals, and the eyes that filled the empty sockets were large and shining. The hump of its great shoulders had shrunk. All its proportions were made finer. Scathus might have been an artist, but he'd been a vile one. Strange the Dreamer was an artist too, and he was the antidote to vile.
What do you think?
Laszlo asked her.
He's actually lovely, she marveled. He would be out of place in a nightmare now.
I'm glad you like him.
You do good work, Dreamsmith.
Dreamsmith. I like the sound of that. And you're one too, of course. We should set up a tent in the marketplace.
Why not dream?
Sarai said, painting a logo onto the air. The letters glimmered gold, then faded, and she imagined a fairy tale life in which she and Laszlo worked magic out of a striped market tent and kissed when there were no customers. She turned to him, shrugged the broad flare of her fox wings back from her shoulders, and wrapped her arms around his waist.
Have I told you that the moment I first stepped into your dreams, I knew there was something special about you?
I don't believe you have, no, said Laszlo, finding a place for his arms about her shoulders, wild, windswept hair and wings and all.
Please, go on. Even before you looked at me, saw me, I mean, the first person who ever did. After that, of course I knew there was something. But even before, just seeing weep in your mind's eyes, it was so magical. I wanted it to be real, and I wanted to come down and bring Sparrow and Ruby and Feral and Minya and live in it, just the way you dreamed it.
It was all the cake, wasn't it? Goddess bait.
It didn't hurt,
she admitted, laughing. Laszlo sobered.
I wish I could make it all real for you.
Sarai's laugh trailed away.
I know, she said.
The hopelessness didn't come back to either of them, but the reasons for it did.
It was a bad day, said Laszlo. For me too.
They told each other all of it, though Laszlo didn't think it necessary to repeat the warrior's actual words.
It made me think it was impossible, he said.
He traced her cheek with his finger.
But I've thought things were impossible before, and so far, none of them actually were. Besides, I know Errol Fane doesn't want any more killing. He wants to come up to the Citadel, he told her, to meet you.
He does.
The fragile hope in her voice broke Laszlo's hearts. He nodded.
How could he not?
Tears came to her eyes.
I told him you could ask the others to call a truce. I can come too. I'd rather like to meet you.
There had been a soft longing in Sarai's eyes, but now Laszlo saw it harden.
I've already asked, she said.
And they said, No.
Only one of them did, and only her vote matters.
It was time to tell him about Minya. Sarai had described Ruby and Sparrow and Feral to him already, and even the Ellens, because they all fit in the loveliness here and the sweetness of this night. Minya didn't. Even the thought of her infected it. She told him first how Minya had saved the rest of them from the carnage, which she had witnessed, and she told him the strange fact of her agelessness. Last, she told him of her gift.
The Ghost Army. It's hers. When someone dies, their souls are pulled upward, up toward, I don't know, the sky. They have no form, no ability to move. They can't be seen or heard, except by her. She catches them and binds them to her, gives them form, and makes them her slaves.
Laszlo shuddered at the thought. It was power over death, and it was every bit as grim a gift as the ones the Mazathim had had. It cast a dark pall over his optimism.
"She'll kill anyone who comes," Sarai said. "You mustn't let Errol Fane come. You mustn't come. Please don't doubt what she can and will and wants to do."
"Then what are we to do?" he asked, at a loss. There was, of course, no answer. Not tonight, at least. Sarai looked up at the citadel. By the light of the low-hanging stars, it looked like an enormous cage.
"I don't want to go back yet," she said.
Laszlo drew her closer.
"It's not morning yet," he said.
He waved his hand and the citadel vanished, as easily as that. He waved it again, and the anchor vanished too, right out from under their feet. They were in the sky again, flying. The city shone far below, glaive light and golden domes. The sky glimmered all around, starlight and infinity, and altogether too many seconds had passed since their last kiss. Laszlo thought, "All of this is ours, even the infinity." And then he turned it. He turned gravity, because he could. Sarai wasn't expecting it. Her wings were keeping her up, but then up became down, and she tumbled. Exactly as Laszlo had planned it, right into his arms. She gave a little gasp and then fell silent as he caught her full against him. He wrapped his wings around them, and together they fell, not toward the ground, but away, into the depths of the sky. They fell into the stars in a rush of air and ether. They breathed each other's breath. They had never been this close. It was all velocity and dream physics. No more need to stand or lean or fly, but only fall. They were both already fallen. They would never finish falling. The universe was endless, and love had its own logic. Their bodies curved together, pressed, and found their perfect fit. Hearts, lips, navels, all their strings wound tight. Laszlo's palm spread open on the small of Sarai's back. He held her close against him. Her fingers twined through his long dark hair. Their mouths were soft and slow. Their kisses on the ground had been giddy. This one was different. It was reverent. It was a promise, and they trailed fire like a comet as they made it. He knew it wasn't his will that brought them to their landing. Sarai was a dreamsmith too, and this choice was all her own. Laszlo had given her the moon on her wrist, the stars that bedecked it, the sun in its jar on the shelf with the fireflies. He had even given her wings. But what she wanted most in that moment wasn't the sky. It was the world and broken things, and hand-carved beams and tangled bed covers, and a lovely tattoo round her navel, like a girl with the hope of a future. She wanted to know all the things that bodies are for, and all the things that hearts can feel. She wanted to sleep in Laszlo's arms, and she wanted to not sleep in them. She wanted...
she wanted. She wanted to wake up holding hands.
Sarai wished, and the dream obeyed. Laszlo's room replaced the universe. Instead of stars, glaives. Instead of the cushion of endless air, there was, beneath her, the soft give of feathers. Her weight settled onto it, and Laszlo's onto her, and all with the ease, the rightness, of choreography meeting its music. Sarai's robe was gone. Her slip was pink as petals, the straps gossamer fine against the azure of her skin. Laszlo rose up on his elbow and gazed down at her in wonder. He traced the line of her neck, dizzy with this new topography. Here were her collarbones, as he had seen them that first night. He leaned down and kissed the warm dip between them. His fingertips traced up the length of her arm, and paused to roll the fine silk strap between them. Holding her gaze, he eased it aside. Her body rose against his, her head falling back to expose her throat. He covered it with his mouth, then kissed a path down to her bare shoulder. Her skin was hot, and his mouth was hot, and it was still all only a beginning. That was not what Thion Nero saw when he came to peer in Laszlo's window. Not lovers, and no beautiful blue maiden. Just Laszlo alone, dreaming, and somehow radiant. He was giving off bliss, Thion thought, the way a glaive gives light. And was that a moth perched on his brow? And Thion's lip curled in disgust. On the wall above the bed and on the ceiling beams, wings softly stirring. Moths. The room was infested with them. He knelt and picked up some pebbles and weighed them on his palm. He took careful aim, drew back his hand, and threw. Chapter 57. The Secret Language. Laszlo shot upright, blinking. The moth spooked from his brow and all the others from the wall to flutter up to the ceiling and beat around the beams. But he wasn't thinking about the moths. He wasn't thinking. The dream had pulled him down so deep that he was underneath thought, submerged in a place of pure feeling. And what feeling? Every feeling. And with the sense that they'd been stripped down to their essence, revealed for the first time in all their unspeakable beauty, their unbearable fragility. There was no part of him that knew he was dreaming, or, more to the point, that he was suddenly not dreaming. He only knew that he was holding Sarai, the flesh of her shoulder, hot and smooth against his mouth, and then he wasn't. Twice before, the dream had broken and stolen her away. But those other times he'd understood what was happening. Not now. Now he experienced it as though Sarai herself, flesh and breath and hearts and hope, melted to nothing in his arms. He tried to hold on to her, but it was like trying to hold on to smoke or shadow, or the reflection of the moon. He felt all of Sathaz's helplessness. Even as he sat up in his bed, in this room where Sarai had never been, the air seemed to cling to the curves of her, warm with traces of her scent and heat, but empty, forsaken, devoid. Those other times he'd felt frustration. This was loss, and it tore something open inside him.
"No!"
he gasped, surfacing fast to be spilled back into reality, like someone beached by the crash of a wave. The dream receded and left him there, in his bed, alone, stranded in the merciless intransigence of reality. And it was as bleak a truth to his soul as the nothingness of the Elmuthaleth. He exhaled with a shudder, his arms giving up on the sweet, lost phantom of Sarai. Even her fragrance was gone. He was awake, and he was alone. Well, he was awake.
He heard a sound, a faint, incredulous chuff, and spun toward it. The shutters were